details in that hole, in that sharia, you know? And when, for example, you cannot choose something in this sharia and tell me that, okay, I'm going to go through another country, that women are not Muslim, so I'm not going to make hijab. No, it's not like that.
Exactly.
When you accept this religion, you have to accept all of the details in this religion. Even in this religion, we have two different categories of responsibilities and actually activities, personal and social.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think when you go through another country which is non-Muslim or something, doing the activity which are personal is somehow easier.
Exactly.
But it's not impossible to actually do your responsibility in activities which are social.
It's not impossible, but it's still difficult.
Yeah, it's more difficult.
Yeah, so alhamdulillah, I have lived in non-Muslim countries most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely possible to be a Muslim, a good Muslim. When I say Muslim, I mean practicing Muslim.
Yeah.
It's definitely difficult, seeing that human beings naturally are influenced by people who are around them. So, it's definitely a challenge. There's two things as well to consider. One is that being practicing Muslim in our actions, and the other one is our ideology and our belief system. Now, what I've noticed a lot, especially what happens in Western countries, so the America and North America and Europe, is that you find a lot of Muslims who are practicing Muslims in their actions, but in their thinking, they very much think in a non-Muslim way.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And recently that's become a bit more troubling than actually, you know, not being a practicing Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
See, because when you don't practice Islam, you're not doing the outward action. It's easy to spot that. But when you're influenced by a non-Islamic thinking, it's something that's really hard to pinpoint.
Exactly.
And you don't realize that, right? It's something that you're living thinking you're a Muslim, but in reality, if you look inside yourself and you really try to look at your beliefs through a magnifying glass, you realize that a lot of your beliefs are non-Islamic. And this is where I feel the biggest danger is in living in non-Muslim countries,
yeah,
where your core beliefs, the thing that makes you who you really are as a Muslim, those things are affected.
Pandora's box is opened now. Let's go for a short break, and after that, we'll go for the rest of our topic.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
How do you feel when you go to a non-Muslim country and then you have to practice your rituals, you have to be your true you and be a good Muslim?
Even with the small, small things that, for example, people living in Iran might not even think about it.
Yeah.
So the first time, for example, I came to Iran, it was very awkward to go to the supermarket and just pick up stuff put in your basket and just pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in the UK, for example, everything you pick up, even if it's something like a biscuit or a cereal,
yeah,
you always
chocolate.
Turn the thing, look at the ingredients,
yeah,
right? Because there's a lot of, for example, animal ingredients that are used even in something as innocent as a cereal or a cake or something like that. Right?
Exactly.
So I remember still going down the aisles and, you know, pick up something like, for example, hot chocolate. I don't know. Just pick it up and just check
even
if behind
chocolate.
It. You know,
yeah.
Even, you know, small things like this. That
exactly.
When you come to an Islamic country, you don't have that need. And it's really nice. And you really appreciate them living in an Islamic country. You feel freer. You know how they say that Islam restricts you and so on? It's not like that. It's like when you come here, you really feel free.
Exactly.
You know, you feel like you can put your hands down and, you know, live a comfortable life, because now you don't have that constant pressure of being forced, socially forced, to disobey Allah.
Sister,
yeah.
Now as a woman, I would like to ask you, usually for men, it's pretty much easier.
I do agree.
To keep everything just the same as they are and then to travel into another country and mm-hmm. then be who they are. But for women, it's a bit of different, you know. If you are going to go for education, then you are going to enter a university full of people who are just not like you. And then you are going to be distinguished among the crowd.
Yeah.
And it's a hard, sad feeling, I guess.
It is, actually, because in any actually aspect, being different is somehow difficult. Because no matter, you are better or you are, you know, less than them.
Superior or inferior.
Yeah, exactly. It is always difficult to be different. And even I think it's more difficult when it comes to your appearance. When you have something which makes you different from another society, it's like, okay, this feeling of looking down on you is somehow bothering. And
exactly.
I do agree with that one. Just make it slightly. right.
You mean you can still have hijab, but not so much distinguished as you have all the eyes on you.
Yeah, exactly. And I had always this question, but I think the answer is you can be yourself wherever you are. And this is freedom, you know. In other countries, especially developed countries, they claim that we actually provide you with freedom. Mm-hmm. You can be whatever you want. And I want to be this, I want to be that. So you have to allow me to be this, first of all, and then you have to accept me.
But
and
actually, we know that it's easier said than done.
Yeah.
I feel outnumbered, but I don't think...
Sorry.
I would disagree with you saying that it's much easier for men than for women.
How come?
Because I think it's true that a Muslim woman has the hijab, and in one way she stands out in society, so in a Muslim society. But I feel for men is possibly as hard, because we may not stand out in the sense that when people look at us, but there are certain challenges, because there are certain challenges that we have to go through that women might not need to go through, right? There's a certain amount of acceptability that we have to have in society, especially, for example, if a woman gets married and you know, a lot of her time is spent being a mother, the man has to go in the workplace, he has to go out, he has to interact with people, and he has to be constantly at the face of a society that is not accepting him, right? And that is difficult, right? There's different sins that are out there. There's people you have to interact with on a daily basis at the workplace. And I feel this is quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So I think both men and women have their own challenges
in society. Yeah, but you know, the war that happens to a man is actually an internal war. And the thing that happens to a woman is more outer. You know what I mean? What happens is that you would be bombarded with too much of eyes on you. And it is going to be pretty much difficult. But the thing that happens to men is actually more of an internal thing. It's an internal challenge.
Even as a Muslim man, people can tell I'm a Muslim, right? Firstly, I'm a foreigner, right?
Yeah.
I'm brown skin. So if you're in Europe, then you already stand out. And then having a beard, for example, that makes you stand out, for example, right? So already people's eyes are on us as much as they are on the women.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say that I agree that having the hijab is a challenge. Right. But this idea that, you know, it's so much more difficult for women than it is for men. This is the part that I disagree with. I think men have their share of challenges. And in today's world, it's all about, you know, women are suffering.
Yeah.
Hello, men are also suffering.
So in this part, I have to agree with you. Actually, this is challenging for both, you know, men and women. But actually, despite the fact that it is really hard to be a Muslim person in a non-Muslim country, one thing which is, I think, harder and more difficult and more challenging is bringing up a child.
Yeah.
Which should be a Muslim in a non-Muslim country, you know? And I think this is a challenge that I always was searching the answer for that. For example, you have a child which is going to go through a kind of school which is non-Muslim, and all the other children are eating something which you are not sure about the ingredients of that thing, or even for girls, hijab or something. And
well, now this
issue
is nothing compared to other issues, because now you can go and pick the kind of food for your children yourself. If you
You cannot control other
I'm talking about other things, you know.
So
the other things are more dangerous, because then your child is going to go from a society which has been just the same as him or her, but now they're entering a new society in which everything is broader. We had a relative, and he used to say that when his son didn't go to school, then they came from the school into the house, and they started to go to the room and close the room, and then it started bombarding the kid about what happened. Why didn't you come to your school? Is there anything bothering you? Is there blah, blah? And you know how kids are. You cannot trust whatever they say, but if they say something wrong, then it would be so custy. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. Because they're growing up at a stage where they don't have a strong free will yet.
Exactly.
So they're going to be exposed to many things, and who knows how it's impacting them. Hopefully, inshallah, if we do the tarbiyah properly, then hopefully that child, when they've reached that maturity, would be strong enough to make their own decisions.
Yeah, I wish all the parents luck in upbringing their children. Now let's go for a short break, after which we'll pursue our discussion. Welcome back. This is Back to Reality. We are talking about living in another country in which people are not practicing the same religion as you do.
When this comes to social matters, it's a whole new ballgame. You know, you can protect yourself in your personal things. And one of the things that the sister mentioned at the start of the program with regards to your involvement in social matters, this is really key, right? You have the choice to live in a non-Muslim country and mind your own business. But again, as your responsibility as a Muslim is that you should get involved in social matters. If there is injustice, then you should stand up against it. You know, if somebody is suffering, you should be helping them. And this is where it gets really challenging. What's too less and what's too much in this, right? So you always get confused, especially when you live in a country that's politically a bit very different to what Islam would have in mind. Mm-hmm. Should I be doing more? Should I become an activist? You know, and that could even lead to risking your own life. Right.
Exactly.
So if you look at Islam in a broader sense, and it's not just about me, but about society as well, then your challenges as a Muslim become manifold, right? It's a lot more that you need to think about. And also you're representing Islam to the people. If people want to know what's a Muslim or what is Islam, and you're the only Muslim in the area, then they're going to be like, okay, let me see what kind of person this person is. And it's not only for the scholars, right? We have our own duty, but every single Muslim living in a non-Muslim country is actually holding the flag of Islam.
There are some Islamic countries that they call themselves Islamic, but actually when you go through them, for example, hijab is not a rule for all the people, or there are some rules which, for example, Muslim people can do and non-Muslim people cannot do, you know?
Yeah.
And there is no necessity or obligation for example, these parts of this religion for them, but they call them Islamic. And that was really bothering for me.
They actually call themselves Islamic, but do not act accordingly.
Yeah.
You would have expectations from a so-called Islamic country to put certain rules that makes you as a Muslim feel safer and more relaxed to live as a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing you know is everywhere you go, there's a pub, there's a casino. It's like, come on, we're supposed to be at home over here, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely, it's quite sad.
So I guess it's all about security, that we have to search for the things that exist in our religion in order to be practiced in a country, in a society, whatever. But we actually were talking about living in a foreign country that carries the different perspectives about religion, and they do not actually practice the same religion as us. So we said that there must be so much of difficulties as a woman or as a man. The basement is usually the most important thing that matters.
You've made it sound very bleak and dark.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who live there and successfully as good Muslims, alhamdulillah. And whilst it's difficult, it's still very doable. And if we have enough knowledge and we know what we need to take care of, if we know the type of places we shouldn't be going to, we know the type of food we shouldn't be eating and stuff, and we have a conscious mind, then we can live a good life.
Yeah, right? And
we
then
can live a
by
good
time,
life, can be comfortable.
What we were talking about was actually the first days of getting there. Because
yes,
after a certain time, as human beings get accustomed to everything very easily, you will just get used to it.
You'll get used to it. You'll know what to keep an eye out for.
So I guess this is all the time that we had for today's episode. Thank you, dear guests. And thank you, dear listeners,
thank
for staying
much.
With us.
Thank you.
Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and save you from all the evils. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin. يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رائزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رائزك لتصي دليلتك Once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Taliban's Ministry of Voice and Virtue have banned Afghan women from visiting all parks, using gyms, and public baths.
Recently, women are banned from going to parks, sports clubs, and public baths by the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. For the past 15 months, the orders given to these places were violated and ignored. That's why now it is decided that they should be banned. It is not clear how long the restrictions would last or whether they are going to be lifted.
The famous city park in Kabul, once filled with families' joy and laughter, now has turned idle and silent, with only a handful of men wandering through the complex. The ban order has also affected the livelihoods of people who have been making ends meet by working at public places.
They are interrupting our livelihoods with their decisions. Now they have banned women, so less customers are visiting here. Look, it's in the middle of the day, but no visitors. I have rented a photography shop here, and I used to have an adequate income. But now the ban is making me close it down.
Women rights activists urge the Taliban to reverse its course on all women's rights, saying such decisions would provoke national outrage.
Instead of attempting to ban the doors of parks for women, the Taliban should manage to let Afghan boys and girls learn. They should address the economic and humanitarian crisis in the country rather than focusing on weird restrictions on women. I'm sure such decisions expose the reality of the Taliban and would face public anger.
The Taliban have already banned women from traveling without a male relative. Secondary schools for girls have also been shut for over a year across the country. Afghan women are worried about being barred from public places after the authorities announced the new restrictions. The women are now calling for justice, demanding the authorities protect their rights. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Shah-e-Darab, a week-long exhibition in Indian-administered Kashmir is displaying dozens of rare manuscripts written by prominent poet Khwaja Muhammad Amin Darab. The language was once officially used in courts and commerce until 1889. The organizers say the aim of the event is to revive Persian language in the region. About 73 manuscripts, including a dozen books written by Darab, are on display.
Persian is so deeply entrenched that you can't think of our craft without Persian. You can't think of Kashmiri language, forget about Persian, without Persian language. You can't think of our basic ethical and sacred knowledge without Persian.
Persian is what Kashmir is all about. And it still has a resonance in contemporary Kashmiri society. If you go to any urs or any major shrine of Kashmir, the manqabat and the naats that are recited will be jami. They will be in Persian.
Chronogram on Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon, Maharaja of Kashmir's accession to the throne in 1923, elegies of prominent scholars, including on the death of Muslim scholar and jurist Maulana Anwar Shah Kashmiri, are being displayed in the exhibition. Darab was instrumental in transmitting traditional Persian literature in the region. He is also known as a master of Kitah-e-Tariq and Naats in the praise of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Darab died in 1979 in Srinagar, but his memories and writings continue to enlighten hearts and minds in the region. The remnants of Persian verses are widely recited in mosques, shrines, Sufi and spiritual gatherings. The Persian language reached its peak in Kashmir during the Mughal rule, but faded with the course of time. The exhibition organizers say events like this are an ideal platform to revive Persian language and literature.
I want people to know what he has written, because if you keep it in boxes, nobody would know. Maybe the language is not here anymore, but the language never dies. See, even now some people are so interested in it, that's why we are getting a good response. And there is so much of culture in this language, there is so much of history about Kashmir as well in the language, because it's somehow connected with Iran.
Organizers say Darab's contribution to Persian literature in the valley is also highlighted in documentation of the greatest poets, Ghani Kashmiri. Munawar Zaman, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Monday, the European Union announced new sanctions on a number of Iranian officials and three organizations, including Iran's 24-hour English news channel Press TV, for alleged crackdown on protests which began following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who collapsed in police custody and was pronounced dead a few days later at hospital. The state broadcaster is accused of airing, quote, forced confessions of detainees, according to an EU statement. A baseless claim that has surprised Press TV staff and managers, as no such forced confessions have been produced or broadcast by the English language news channel during the recent riots. On the contrary, the news channel has made a great effort to counter fake narratives fostered by Western media.
They make claims about Press TV producing and airing forced confessions. I've been working here at Press TV for almost a decade now, and I can tell you that Press TV has not aired any confessions whatsoever, forced or unforced. So that shows you how such decisions by the EU and the like are based on unfounded claims with no basis in reality. You know, I see this as part of their hybrid warfare against Iran. If you look at the big picture, you see them supporting terrorist groups. And these sanctions on Press TV I see as part of the media war and their narrative control. They want to present the war with their distorted version of what's going on in Iran these days, and seemingly they don't feel much comfortable with Press TV challenging their narrative. So they would try everything to silence us or make us less heard, but we're not going to be silenced.
Riots broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Mahsa Amini. Rioters brutally attacked security officers and caused massive damage to public property. Iran's intelligence ministry has revealed that the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. Experts believe that sanctions imposed on Press TV by the EU and earlier by the government of Canada are aimed at muzzling free speech and alternative views. And once again, the term human rights violations has turned into a tool for Western countries to advance their own agenda, as street riots in Iran don't seem to be achieving the goals they expected. Taking into consideration all the different aspects, Press TV is not discouraged by the unfair treatment and false accusations. Despite all obstacles, Press TV will continue to be the voice of the voiceless, reporting underreported stories and news overlooked by mainstream media. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
When there's mutual trust, a deal is a deal. It's this easy to arrive at an agreement when the two sides of the bargain are from Russia and Iran. These B2B meetings come as part of an economic forum held in Tehran between Iranian businesses and over 100 companies from Russia.
We are a Russian logistic company, and we're here to participate in this business forum to find some partners for business with Iran. We are thinking to transport goods to Iran, from Iran, through Iran.
Our activity is about gas, oil, petrochemical equipment, machinery, instrument. We can export many items to Russian companies. For example, as the machinery, as raw material, and it can help both sides to develop their business relationship as soon as possible.
Tehran and Moscow's interests coincide on many fronts. Both are faced with U.S. sanctions, and both are signatories to the 2015 deal, which has faced troubles following the U.S. withdrawal from the pact in 2018 and the reinstatement of sanctions on Iran. While the bans have adversely affected the Russo-Iranian trade, businessmen here believe there's a strong will from both Tehran and Moscow to overcome those restrictions.
I don't think it will be like a very, very big problem for our countries. Just, we have a border, we have a Caspian Sea, and we can transport cargo. This sanction, it is some problem for the trading, for the money transferring, but it's okay for logistics, no problem.
The American measures have complicated the Russian-Iranian commercial ties when it comes to money transfer and banking transactions. While alternatives such as the use of national currencies have already paid off, legal experts attending this forum say they have a better way out. Cryptocurrency.
Using cryptocurrencies, Iran and Moscow can effectively ditch the U.S. dollar. So if the two sides include this transaction method in their contracts, they can proceed with their businesses seamlessly without any concern over the impacts of U.S. measures.
Visits between Iranian and Russian officials have in recent months increased, following the West tightening its economic measures against both countries. Tehran and Moscow are now eyeing a 20-year strategic partnership treaty that would lay out the roadmap for future expansion of ties at all levels, from politics to economy and security.
This year, Tehran and Russia traded some $4 billion worth of commodities, roughly 90% up compared to last year's trade volume. Now, given the growing relationship between the two sides, the Iran-Russia Chamber of Commerce predicts that this figure will hit $10 billion by 2024. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In just the past 9 months, the EU and US have together pumped €32 billion worth of lethal weapons into Ukraine. At a meeting here in Brussels on Tuesday, EU defence ministers agreed to increase their military spending by a huge amount between now and the end of 2025.
€70 billion.
Apparently, there is an urgent need to replace weapons being sent to Ukraine.
The supply of arms to Ukraine, it's a continuous flow. It flows every day. And every day there is a member state who provides more. The system has already been provided. I don't think we need new systems. What they need is ammunition to make the systems work.
One expert we interviewed online told us it is a dangerous policy.
The problem with further funding is that it suggests further escalation. An escalation is hazardous because by intent or by miscalculation, it can lead all of the parties into a nuclear conflict.
Many peace activists and rights groups say the military spending is grotesque given the EU's growing social crisis. Those in the European Parliament who oppose NATO and are calling for peace talks between Russia and Ukraine are furious at attempts to silence them.
We talk about democracy, but where is this going to end up? Those you brand as populist and anti-European have a democratic right to disagree with you on the course that Europe is taking.
Defence ministers have agreed to establish camps in up to 20 EU nations that will be used to train Ukrainian soldiers. Some security analysts are suggesting long-standing, controversial ambitions to create an EU army within the EU have effectively been put on hold. And now the strategy is to create an EU army in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Iran insists that recent riots in the country were orchestrated by outside adversaries such as the United States. But EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on Monday took a different view. They have agreed on new sanctions against Iran, claiming the rioters are seeking freedom.
To support them, today the Council adopted another 31 listing under the Iran human rights regime.
The channel you are watching now, Press TV, has also been added to the EU sanctions list. Press TV management has vehemently rejected claims by the EU that the channel broadcast forced confessions from detainees during recent riots in Iran. EU officials have been asked to provide evidence to back up the claims, but it's already clear that will not be forthcoming, simply because it never happened. This latest set of sanctions follows similar measures against Iran taken by the EU in October.
Iran is geographically in a very strong position because they can decide, OK, if the European Union is going to make life harder in terms of sanctions, we can close or threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. That means that Qatar, which is the principal supplier, I think about 70% of gas is coming from Qatar these days, will be stranded.
One EU minister says the new sanctions should not be allowed to derail talks around the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
I hope that this can be kept separated because of JCPOA negotiations, of course, it has a long history already, and I would say it's this close that we could get an agreement on JCPOA.
During a debate on human rights in the European Parliament a few days ago, the EU was accused of displaying double standards.
Europe has invaded and butchered millions, plundered and committed genocide, overthrown and murdered revolutionaries, backed brutal dictators, imposed murderous sanctions.
Amid growing economic turmoil in the EU, many experts claim sanctions against Russia have backfired. In other words, sanctions don't work. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A high-ranking Venezuelan delegation is in Tehran to take part in a joint economic meeting with the Islamic Republic. The purpose of the commission is to deepen cooperation in strategic areas as part of a 20-year agreement signed between the two countries.
This is the 9th Joint Economic Commission, and as you know, representatives from both sides have identified potential areas of cooperation in different fields, including transportation, industries, agriculture, energy, science, and technology. We will be trying to find ways to facilitate trade between the two countries to boost bilateral relations in order to avert the consequences of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic of Iran and Venezuela are two independent states that share common views about many regional and international issues, such as seeking independence, the right to self-determination, and a multipolar world order.
Nosotros lo que estamos mostrando es...
We care about the well-being of our nations. Our values are different from imperialistic countries. Now that our people and our governments are united, we can avert the U.S. sanctions and allow out countries to prosper through bilateral cooperation and a strong political and economic ties.
Part of our scientific cooperation and training includes ways to advance new trends in molecular biology, biotechnology, and proteomics for cancer treatment.
In Venezuela, we have been testing regenerative agriculture in order to avoid desertification. We have achieved excellent results, and now we are ready to share our experiences with Iran.
Iran and Venezuela signed a 20-year cooperation roadmap during a state visit by President Nicolas Maduro to Tehran in June 2022, as the two oil-rich countries sanctioned by the U.S. pledged to boost bilateral ties. The 9th Joint Economic Commission of Iran and Venezuela will be going on for another 3 days. It is expected to pave the way for implementing the cooperation agreements signed between the two countries in different fields. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The European Union's Executive Commission slashed its forecast for economic growth next year, saying the 19 countries that use the euro currency will slide into recession over the winter as peak inflation hangs on for longer than expected and high fuel and heating costs erode consumer purchasing power. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Euronews reported that the Eurozone and most EU countries will head to an economic recession in late quarter of 2022, according to the European Commission's autumn economic forecast. The economic situation has deteriorated markedly and we are heading into two quarters of contraction, said EU Economy Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni at a press conference. The EU's executive revised up its inflation forecast from July, predicting that prices would peak at year-end and remain high in 2023. Inflation will average 9.3% in the EU and 8.5% in the Eurozone for 2022, Brussels said. The EU is among the most exposed advanced economies to high prices, due to its geographical proximity to the war and heavy reliance on gas imports from Russia, the European Commission said in a statement. The energy crisis is eroding households' purchasing power and weighing on production. While prices are expected to come down in 2023, inflation is still predicted to be at 7% in the EU and 6.1% in the Eurozone, before decreasing to 3% in the EU and 2.6% in the Euro area in 2024. The EU forecast was based on the assumption that geopolitical tensions, such as the crisis in Eastern Europe, would neither normalize nor escalate, and that sanctions against Russia would remain in place. But Gentiloni said the impact of adopted or planned fiscal energy measures adds uncertainty to the forecast for energy inflation. Average inflation for 2022 was highest in the Baltics, where it was forecast to be 19.3% in Estonia, 18.9% in Lithuania, and 16.9% in Latvia this year. RT had a look on this issue, writing, food inflation in Finland saw a year-on-year increase of 15.7% last month. TASS reported recently, citing data released by the country's statistics center. The price surge, reportedly the steepest since Finland joined the European Union 27 years ago, has been attributed to a rise of prices for fertilizers and energy carriers caused by the coronavirus pandemic and the conflict in Ukraine. The EU is facing a sharp rise in energy prices and record inflation amid anti-Russia sanctions and a policy of abandoning Russian oil, natural gas, coal, and other commodities. The situation is expected to lead to energy rationing and shortages across the entire region. The biggest jump was recorded for flour, eggs, coffee, and butter. Prices for flour increased 46%, while those for other food products soared by more than 30%. Prices will continue to rise until the end of the year and at least in the first half of the next one, said Jarkki Niemi, research professor at Natural Resources Institute Finland, as quoted by the agency. Recently, preliminary Eurostat data showed that in October, inflation in Finland rose to 8.3%. marking the lowest rate among EU member states after Malta. Last month, Eurostat reported that the price of coffee in EU had seen an average year-on-year surge of nearly 17%, with Finland leading the ranking. The jump in coffee prices in the country reached 44% for the 12 months to August 2022. Shop owners in Germany are worried about the upcoming Christmas season, expecting a slump in sales in price-adjusted terms as double-digit inflation driven by energy prices forced people to shop less in the third quarter, the German Retail Association, HDE, says. According to the latest report, sales will face a 4% drop in price-adjusted terms despite an expected increase by 5.4% year-on-year in nominal terms projected for the last 2 months of 2022. The association surveyed 500 companies, and 70% of the respondents said they expect worse business conditions in the upcoming Christmas season than last year. There is a great deal of uncertainty among both companies and customers in view of the difficult situation with enormous energy price increases. High inflation and poor consumer sentiment do not really bode well for the Christmas season, HDE Managing Director Stefan Gent said. In October, the German Federal Statistical Office reported that the harmonized inflation rate in Europe's largest economy climbed to 11.6%, raising fears that the country will slide into a recession this winter. The Associated Press recently reported British food prices rose at the fastest pace since 1980 in September, driving inflation back to a 40-year high and heaping pressure on the embattled government to balance the books without gutting the health for the nation's poorest residents. Food prices jumped 14.6% in the year through September, led by the soaring cost of staples such as meat, bread, milk and eggs. The Office for National Statistics said recently that pushed consumer price inflation back to 10.1%, the highest since early 1982, and equal to the level last reached in July. The crisis in Eastern Europe has boosted food and energy prices worldwide, with shipments of natural gas, grains and cooking oil disrupted. That added to price rises that began last year as the global economy started to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and oh God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another program of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the issues that is not an old issue, it is a historical issue as well, that has been asked many times, has been answered many times, especially in the Arabic or in Farsi, or even in some of the subcontinental languages such as in Urdu and so on and so forth. Books have been written, answers have been given as to who the Shia are, when did they come about, what practices do they do, what is the source of these practices. The reason why some of these books have been written from the side of the Shi'i ulama is because some of the ulama of other schools of thought have criticized and have attacked the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, saying that this is not an Islamic school, this is not something that was there during the time of the Holy Prophet, for example, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and many other such reasons. Sometimes a book is written in order to introduce the sect to a group of people who may not know anything about that particular sect. As we mentioned, these books were in Arabic, Farsi, or even some of the subcontinental languages such as Urdu or Hindi, maybe. But the book that we are introducing today to our dear listeners is an introduction to Shi'i Islam in the English language, written originally in English, in order to introduce the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam to the English-speaking audience. So please stay tuned for our introduction to this book in our next segment.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves?
Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So as we mentioned previously, the book that we would like to introduce to you is a book that wants to introduce Shi'i Islam to an English-speaking audience. So the book is titled Shi'i Islam, Origins, Faith and Practices. It's quite clear. The book was written by Sheikh Muhammad Ali Shomali and was printed in the United Kingdom, or more likely in London, in the year 2003 for the first time, and then reprinted in 2010. It was published by the Islamic College for Advanced Studies Press, or ICAS Press, in association with International Institute for Islamic Studies. So ICAS Press is in the United Kingdom, it is based in London, whereas the International Institute for Islamic Studies is based in Qom, in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this was a collaboration between these two institutes. The book contains six sections, the first one being Origins of Shi'ism, Sources of Shi'i Thought, Doctrines, Practices, General Characteristics of Islam and Shi'ism, The Shia in the World. Again, this is an introduction clearly from the author. We can see that he wants to introduce Shi'ism to a broader audience or to an English-speaking audience, and to show that no, Shi'ism is part of Islam. It is nothing different from Islam. Yes, there are different practices. There may be certain differences in a particular belief, but the belief in terms of its general manner may be similar. And what is also important is that the interest in the Shi'i faith in the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam really occurred after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran that was led by the great saint, the great arif and mystic of our time, Sayyid Imam Ruhullah Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. And this is what the author himself says in introduction. He writes, however, the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran under the leadership of the Shia ulama, the scholars, particularly Ayatollah Khomeini, aroused further interest in the Shi'i or in the Shia faith. The Islamic Revolution not only played an important role in the revival of Islamic awareness and movements throughout the globe and had a massive impact on the world economy and politics, but also fueled a desire among the general public as well as among politicians and the mass media to know more about Shi'i Islam. So we can see that this book is a particular answer to that call that the Sheikh tries to answer. And he mentions again in his introduction, he says, the present work represents a humble attempt to fill some of the gaps that exist in the field of Islamic studies in general and Shi'i Islam or Shi'i studies in particular. What we know that majority of the studies then was done on the Sunni Islam, the Sunni books. I was not, as the authors rightly said, it was not until the Islamic Revolution and the dialogues that occurred between certain Shi'i scholars and certain Western scholars that this kind of collaboration, this kind of interest was fueled between these two, if you want to call it worlds, the Western, the Islamic world. So this is some of the points that this book tries to do. Again, understand it is an introduction that the author wishes to give to an audience that are new to Shia Islam. So please stay tuned for our next segment where we'll be reading a bit from this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio
with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we introduced to our dear listeners is titled Shia Islam, Origins, Faith and Practices, written by Sheikh Muhammad Ali Shomali and printed by ICAS Press, which is based in London in collaboration with the International Institute for Islamic Studies, which is based in Qum. So one of the chapters, rather the first chapter, and one of probably the most important question that a person who is new to Shia Islam, because a person who is new to Islam or a person who comes to study Islam will say that, oh, where did the sect come from? We knew about the Sunni sect, we knew about the history of the four Khulafa, and so on and so forth. But what about this sect? What is the origins? Were they there at the time of the Holy Prophet, or were they something that came later on? So the first chapter attempts to answer this question. So chapter 1 or section 1, origins of Shiism, the meaning of the term Shia. Most languages have some terms that have two types of meanings, the original or primary and the technical or secondary, basically the literal meaning or the technological meaning or the parlance of that particular word. For example, the term Salah in Arabic originally just meant to supplicate, dua. However, later on it acquired another meaning, i.e. a special type of worship in Islam that is known as namaz in Persian and many other languages, or the five daily prayers that we have, or a Muslim has to do. Of course, as one can see in this case, there must be links and similarities between these two types of meaning. In his Mu'jam al-Maqayis al-Lugha, Ahmed ibn Faris, a renowned philologist of the 5th Islamic century, examines the root of the term Shia, that is Shaya'a, and is Sheen, Ya, and the Ain. He points out two meanings, to aid or help, and to spread. At least one of these two meanings must be found in all derivative forms of this root, whether they are used in their original sense or in their technical sense. For example, the Quran in chapter 24, verse 19, uses a derivative verb of this root to mean to spread. So this is some of the discussions that the author gives, understanding that also what was not mentioned previously is that this was a collection of speeches given by the author on two different occasions and has been compiled into this book. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to find the truth wherever it may be and to hopefully inshallah accept it wholeheartedly. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.